Chapter 26. For a long time, for days, how many days, who knew? Not the trash can man, that was for sure. Donald Merwin Elbert, known to the intimates of his dim and confusing grade school past as the trash can man, had wandered up and down the streets of Poutonville, Indiana, cringing from the voices in his head, dodging away and putting up his hands to shield against stones thrown by ghosts.
"Hey, trash can! Hey, trash can man, digging you, trash. Lit any good fires this week? What old Lady Semple say when you lit up her pension check, trash? Hey, trash baby, want to buy some kerosene? How'd you like those shock treatments down in Terre Haute, trashy? Trash, hey, trash can."
Sometimes he knew those voices weren't real, but sometimes he would cry out loud for them to stop, only to realize that the only voice was his own voice, hitting back at him from the houses and storefronts, bouncing off the cinder block wall of the scrub-a-dubba car wash, where he used to work, and where he now sat on the morning of June 30th, eating a big sloppy sandwich of peanut butter and jelly and tomatoes and Goulden's Diablo mustard. No voice but his voice, hitting the houses and stores and being turned away like an unwanted guest, and thus returning to his own ears. Because somehow, Poutonville was empty. Everyone was gone. Or were they? They said he was crazy, and that's something a crazy man would think, that his hometown was empty except for himself. But his eyes kept returning to the oil tanks on the horizon, huge and white and round, like low clouds. They stood between Poutonville and the road to Gary in Chicago, and he knew what he wanted to do, and that wasn't a dream. It was bad, but not a dream, and he wasn't going to be able to help himself. "Burn your fingers, trash? Hey, trash can man, don't you know playing with fire makes you wet the bed?" Something seemed to whistle past him, and he sobbed and held up his hands, dropping his sandwich into the dust, cringing his cheek into his neck. But there was nothing. There was no one. Beyond the cinder block wall of the scrub-a-dubba car wash, there was only Indiana Highway 130 going to Gary, but first going past the huge Cheery Oil Company holding tanks. Sobbing a little, he picked up his sandwich, brushed the gray dirt off the white bread as best he could, and began to munch it again. Were they dreams? Once his father had been alive, and the sheriff had cut him down in the street right outside the Methodist church, and he had had to live with that his whole life. "Hey, trash, Sheriff Greeley cut your old man down just like a mad dog. You know that, you fucking weirdo?" His father had been in O'Toole's, and there was some bad talk, and Wendell Elbert had a gun, and he murdered the bartender with it, then went home and murdered Trash Can's two older brothers and his sister with it. Oh, Wendell Elbert was a strange fellow with a badass temper, and he had been getting flaky for a long time before that night. Anyone in Poutonville would tell you so. And they would tell you like father, like son. And he would have murdered Trash Can's mother, too, only Sally Elbert had fled screaming into the night with 5-year-old Donald, later to be known as the Trash Can Man, in her arms. Wendell Elbert had stood on the front steps, shooting at them as they fled, the bullets whining and striking on the road, and on the last shot, the cheap pistol, which Wendell had bought from a nigger in a bar located on Chicago's State Street, had exploded in his hand. The flying shrapnel had erased most of his face. He had gone wandering up the street with blood running in his eyes, screaming and waving the remainder of the cheap pistol in one hand, the barrel mushroomed and split like the remains of a novelty exploding cigar. And just as he got to the Methodist church, Sheriff Greeley pulled up in Poutonville's only squad car and commanded him to stand still and drop the gun. Wendell Elbert pointed the remains of his Saturday night special at the sheriff instead, and Greeley gave him both barrels of his over and under. "Hey, trash, you burned your cock off yet?" He looked around for whoever had yelled that. It sounded like Carly Yates or one of the kids that hung out with him. Except Carly wasn't a kid anymore, any more than he was himself. Maybe he could be just Don Elbert again instead of the trash can man. Just like Carly Yates was now just Carl Yates, who sold cars at the stout Chrysler Plymouth dealership here in town. Except that Carl was gone. Everyone was gone. And maybe it was too late for him to be anyone anymore. And he wasn't sitting against the wall of the scrub-a-dubba anymore. He was a mile or more to the northwest of town, walking along 130, and the town of Poutonville was laid out below him like a scale model community on a kid's H.O. railroad table. The oil tanks were only half a mile away, and he had a toolkit in one hand and a 5-gallon can of gas in the other. Oh, it was so bad, but... So after Wendell Elbert had been put underground, Sally Elbert had gotten a job at the Poutonville Cafe, and sometime, in the first or second grade, her one remaining chick, Donald Merwin Elbert, had started lighting fires in people's trash cans and running away.
"Look out, girls, here comes a trash can man. He'll burn up your dresses."
Eek!
It wasn't until the third grade or so that the grown-ups found out who was doing it, and then the sheriff came around. Good old Sheriff Greeley. And he guessed that was how the man who cut his father down in front of the Methodist church ended up being his stepfather. "Hey, Carly, got a riddle for you. How can your father kill your father?" "I don't know, Petey, how?" "I don't know either, but it helps if you're the trash can man." "Hee, hee, hee, ha, ha, ha." He was standing at the head of the gravel drive now, his shoulders aching from carrying the toolkit and the gas. The sign on the gate read, "Cheery Petroleum Company, Incorporated. All visitors must check in at the office. Thanks." A few cars were parked in the lot, not many. Many were standing on flats. Trash Can Man walked up the drive and slipped through the gate, which was standing ajar. His eyes, blue and strange, were fixed on the spidery stairs that wound around the nearest tank in a spiral all the way to the top. There was a chain across the bottom of these stairs, and another sign swung from the chain. This one said, "Keep off. Pumping station closed." He stepped over the chain and started up the stairs. It wasn't right, his mother marrying that Sheriff Greeley. The year he was in the fourth grade, he had started lighting fires in mailboxes. That was the year he burned up old Mrs. Semple's pension check, and he got caught again. Sally Elbert Greeley went into hysterics the one time her new husband mentioned sending the boy to that place down in Terre Haute. "You think he's crazy? How can a 10-year-old boy be crazy? I think you just want to get rid of him. You got rid of his father, and now you want to get rid of him." The only other thing Greeley could do was to bring the boy up on charges, and you can't send a kid of 10 off to reform school, not unless you want him to come out with a size 11 asshole, not unless you wanted your new wife to divorce you. Up the stairs and up the stairs. His feet made little ringing noises on the steel. He had left the voices down below, and no one could throw a stone this high. The cars in the parking lot looked like twinkling corgi toys. There was only the wind's voice, talking low in his ear and moaning an event somewhere. That, and the far-off call of a tree. Trees and open fields spread out all around, all in shades of green, only slightly blued by a dreaming morning haze. He was smiling now, happy, as he followed the steel spiral up and up, around and around. When he got to the tank's flat circular cap, it seemed that he must be standing directly under the roof of the world, and if he reached up, he could scratch blue chalk from the bottom of the sky with his fingernails. He put the gas can and the toolkit down and just looked. From here, you could actually see Gary, because the industrial smokes that usually poured from its factory stacks were absent, and the air up that way was as clear as it was down here. Chicago was a dream wrapped in summer haze, and there was a faint blue glint to the far north that was either Lake Michigan or just wishful thinking. The air had a soft golden aroma that made him think of a calm breakfast in a well-lighted kitchen, and soon the day would burn. Leaving the gas where it was, he took the toolkit over to the pumping machinery and began to puzzle it out. He had an intuitive grasp of machinery. He could handle it the way certain idiot savants can multiply and divide 7-digit numbers in their heads. There was nothing thoughtful or cognitive about it. He simply let his hands wander here and there for a few moments, and then his hands would move with quick, effortless confidence. "Hey, trash can, why'd you want to burn up a church? Why didn't you burn up the school?" When he was in the fifth grade, he had started a fire in the living room of a deserted house in the neighboring town of Sedley, and the house burned flat. His stepfather, Sheriff Greeley, put him in the cooler because a gang of kids had beaten him up, and now the grown-ups wanted to start. Why, if it hadn't rained, we could have lost half the township thanks to that goddamn firebug kid. Greeley told Sally that Donald would have to go down to that place in Terre Haute and have the tests. Sally said she would leave him if he did that to her baby, her only chick. But Greeley went ahead and got the judge to sign the order. And so the trash can man left Powhatanville for a while, for 2 years, and his mother divorced the sheriff, and later that year the voters disowned the sheriff, and Greeley ended up going to Gary to work in an auto assembly line. Sally came to see Trash every week and always cried. Trashcan whispered, "There you are, motherfuck," and then looked around furtively to see if anyone had heard him. Of course no one had, because he was on top of Cheery Oil's number one storage tank, and even if he had been down on the ground, there was no one left, except for ghosts. Above him, fat white clouds floated by. A large pipe projected out of the tangle of pumping machinery, its bore better than 2 feet, its end threaded to take what the oil people called a clutch hose. It was strictly for outflow or overflow, but the tank was now full of unleaded gasoline, and some of it had trickled out, perhaps a pint, cutting shiny tracks through the light dust on the tank. Trashcan stood back, eyes bright, still gripping a large wrench in one hand and a hammer in the other. He dropped them, and they clanged. He wouldn't need the gasoline he'd brought after all. He picked up the can, yelled, "Bombs away!" and dropped it over the side. He watched its tumbling, glinting progress with great interest. A third of the way down, it hit the stairs, bounced off, and then fell all the way to the ground, turning over and over, spraying amber gas from the side that had been punched open when it hit the stairs. He turned back to the outflow pipe. He looked at the shiny puddles of gasoline. He took a package of paper matches from his breast pocket and looked at them, guilty and fascinated and excited. There was an ad on the front that said you could get an education in most anything you wanted at the LaSalle Correspondence School in Chicago. "I'm standing on a bomb," he thought. He closed his eyes, trembling in fear and ecstasy, the old cold excitement on him, making his toes and fingers feel numb. "Hey, Trash, you fucking firebug." The place in Terre Haute let him go when he was 13. They didn't know if he was cured or not, but they said he was. They needed his room so they could put some other crazy kid in it for a couple of years. Trashcan went home. He was way behind in his schoolwork now, and he couldn't seem to catch the hang of it. They had given him shock treatments in Terre Haute, and when he got back to Powhatanville, he couldn't remember things. He would study for a test and then forget half the stuff and flunk with a 60 or a 40 or something like that. For a while, he didn't light any fires. Everything was the way it should be again, it seemed. The father-killing sheriff was gone. He was up there in Gary putting headlights on Dodges. "Putting wheels on miscarriages," his mother sometimes said. His mother was back working in the Powhatanville Cafe. It was all right. Of course, there was Cheery Oil, the white tanks rising on the horizon like oversized whitewashed tin cans, and behind them the industrial smokes from Gary, where the father-killing sheriff was, as if Gary was already on fire. He often wondered how the Cheery Oil tanks would go up. 3 single explosions, loud enough to rip your eardrums to tatters and bright enough to fry your eyeballs in their sockets. 3 pillars of fire, father, son, and holy father-killing sheriff, that would burn day and night for months, or would they maybe not burn at all? Now he would find out. The soft summer breeze puffed out the first 2 matches he lit, and he dropped their blackened stumps onto the riveted steel. Off to his right, near the knee-high railing that circled the edge of the tank, he saw a bug struggling weakly in a puddle of gasoline. "I'm like that bug," he thought resentfully. "And what kind of a world was it where God would leave you stuck in a big sticky mess like a bug in a puddle of gas? It was a world that deserved to burn, that was what." He stood, head bowed, a 3rd match ready to strike when the breeze died. For a while, when he came back, he was called loony and halfwit and torchy. But Carly Yates, who was by then 3 grades ahead, remembered the trash cans, and it was Carly's name that stuck. When he turned 16, he left school with his mother's permission. What do you expect? They ruined him down there in Terre Haute. I'd sue him if I had the money. Shock treatments, they call it. Goddamned electric chair, I call it. And went to work at the scrub-a-dubba car wash. Soaped the headlights, soaped the rocker panels, knocked the wipers, swiped the mirrors. Hey, mister, you want hot wax with that? And for a little while longer, things went their appointed course. People would yell at him from street corners or passing cars, would want to know what old Lady Semple, now 4 years in her grave, had said when he lit up her pension check, or if he had wet the bed after he torched that house over in Sedley. And they'd catcall to each other as they lounged in front of the candy store or leaned in the doorway of O'Toole's. They'd holler to each other to hide their matches or butt their smokes because the trash can man was on his way. The voices all became phantom voices, but the rocks were impossible to ignore when they came whizzing from the mouths of dark alleys or from the other side of the street. Once someone had pegged a half-full can of beer at him from a passing car, and the beer can had struck him on the forehead and had driven him to his knees. That was life. The voices, the occasional flying rock, the scrub-a-dubba. And on his lunch break, he would sit where he had been sitting today, eating the BLT his mother had made for him, looking at the cheery oil tanks and wondering which way it would be. That was life, until one night he found himself in the vestibule of the Methodist church with a 5-gallon can of gasoline, splashing it everywhere, especially on the heaps of old hymnals in the corner, and he had stopped and thought, "This is bad. They'll know who did it. They'll know who did it even if someone else did it, and they'll put you away." He thought about it and smelled gas while the voices fluttered and circled in his head like bats in a haunted belfry. Then a slow smile came to his face, and he had upended the gas can and he had run straight up the center aisle with it, the gas spraying out, all the way from the vestibule to the altar he had run, like a groom late to his own wedding, and so eager that he had begun to spray hot fluid more properly meant for his soon-to-be marriage bed. Then he had run back to the vestibule, had pulled a single wooden match from his breast pocket, had scratched it on the zipper of his jeans, had flung the match at the pile of dripping hymnals, direct hit, ka-flump. And the next day he was riding to the Northern Indiana Correctional Center for Boys, past the black and smoldering ribs of the Methodist Church. And there was Carly Yates leaning against the light standard across from the scrub-a-dubba, a lucky strike pasted in the corner of his mouth, and Carly yelled, "Hey, trash can, why'd you want to burn up a church? Why didn't you burn up the school?" He was 17 when he went to the jail for kids, and when he turned 18, they sent him over to the state prison. And how long was he there? Who knew? Not the trash can man, that was for sure. No one cared that he had burned the Methodist church down. Not in state prison, they didn't. There were people there who had done worse. Murder, rape, breaking open the heads of old lady librarians. Some of the inmates wanted to do something to him, and some of them wanted him to do something to them. He didn't mind. It happened after the lights were out. One man with a bald head had said he loved him. "I love you, Donald." And that was sure better than dodging rocks. Sometimes he would think, "Just as long as I can stay in here forever." But sometimes at night he would dream of cheery oil, and in the dreams it was always a single thundering explosion, followed by two others. And the sound was wham, wham, wham. Huge, toneless explosions, slamming their way into bright daylight, shaping the daylight like the blows of a hammer shape thin copper. And everyone in town would stop what they were doing and look north, toward Gary, toward where the three tanks stood against the sky, like oversized, whitewashed tin cans. Carly Yates would be trying to sell a 2-year-old Plymouth Fury to a young couple with a baby, and he would stop in mid-spiel and look. The idlers in O'Toole's and in the candy store would crowd outside, leaving their beers and chocolate malteds behind. In the cafe, his mother would pause in front of the cash register. The new boy at the scrub-a-dubba would straighten from the headlights he had been soaping, the sponge glove still on his hand, looking north as that huge and portentous sound sledgehammered its way into the thin copper routine of the day. Wham! That was his dream. He became a trustee somewhere along the line, and when the strange sickness came, they sent him to the infirmary. And some days ago, there had been no more sick people because all of those who had been sick were now dead. Everybody was dead or had run off, except for a young guard named Jason Debbins, who sat behind the wheel of a prison laundry truck and shot himself. And where else did he have to go then, except home? He struck another match and dropped it. The burning match landed in a small pool of gasoline, and the gas caught. The flames were blue. They spread out delicately, a kind of corona with the burned match stub at its center. Trash Can watched for a moment, paralyzed with fascination, and then he stepped quickly to the stairs that circled around the tank to the bottom, looking back over his shoulder. He could see the pumping machinery through a heat haze now, flickering back and forth like a mirage. The blue flames, no more than 2 inches high, spread toward the machinery and toward the open pipe in a widening semicircle. The bug's struggles had ended. It was nothing but a blackened husk. I could let that happen to me. But he didn't seem to want to. It seemed vaguely that there might be another purpose in his life now, something very grand and great. So he felt a touch of fear, and he began to descend the steps on the run, his shoes clanging, his hand slipped quickly over the steep, rust-pitted railing. Down and down, circling, wondering how long until the vapor hanging around the mouth of the outflow pipe would catch, how long before heat great enough for ignition would rush down the pipe's throat and into the tank's belly. Hair flying back from his forehead, a terrified grin pasted to his face, the wind roaring in his ears, he rushed down. Now he was halfway, racing past the letters CH, letters 20 feet high and lime green against the white of the tank. Down and down, and if his flying feet stuttered or caught on anything, he would tumble like the gas can had tumbled, his bones breaking like dead branches. The ground came closer, the white gravel around the tanks, the green grass beyond the gravel. The cars in the parking lot began to regain their normal size. And still he seemed to be floating, floating in a dream, and he would never reach the bottom, only run and run and get nowhere. He was next to a bomb, and the fuse was lit. From far overhead there came a sudden loud bang, like a 5-inch 4th of July firecracker. There was a dim clang, and then something whirred past him. It was part of the outflow pipe, he saw with a sharp and almost delicious fear. It was totally black and twisted into a new and excitingly senseless shape by the heat. He placed one hand on the railing and vaulted over, hearing something snap in his wrist. Sickening pain flowed up his arm to the elbow. He dropped the last 25 feet, landed on the gravel, and went sprawling. The gravel scraped skin from his forearms, but he hardly felt it. He was full of moaning, grinning panic now, and the daylight seemed very bright. Trash Can Man scrambled up, craning his head around and back, sending his gaze up even as he began to run again. The top of this middle tank had grown yellow hair, and the hair was growing at an amazing rate. The whole thing could blow at any second. He ran, his right hand flopping on its broken wrist. He leaped over the parking lot curb, and his feet slapped on asphalt. Now he was across the parking lot, his shadow trailing at his feet, and now he was running straight down the wide gravel access road and bolting through the half-open gate and back onto Highway 130. He ran straight across it and flung himself into the ditch on the far side, landing on a soft bed of dead leaves and wet moss, his arms wrapped around his head, the breath tearing in and out of his lungs like stabbing jackknives. The oil tank blew. Not wham, but kawhap, a sound so huge, yet at the same time so short and guttural, that he felt his eardrums actually press in and his eyeballs press out as the air somehow changed. A second explosion followed, then a third, and Trash Can writhed on the dead leaves and grinned and screamed soundlessly. He sat up, holding his hands over his ears, and sudden wind struck him and slapped him flat with such power that he might have been no more than a piece of litter. The young saplings behind him bent over backward, and their leaves made a frantic whirring sound, like the pennants over a used car lot on a windy day. One or two snapped with small flat cracking sounds, as if someone was shooting a target pistol. Burning pieces of the tank started to fall on the other side of the road, some actually on the road. They hit with a clanging noise, the rivets still hanging in some chunks, twisted and black, as the outflow pipe had been. Kawham! Trash Can sat up again and saw a gigantic fire tree beyond the Cheery Oil parking lot. Black smoke was billowing from its top, rising straight to an amazing height before the wind could disrupt it and rafter it away. You couldn't look at it without squinting your eyes almost shut, and now there was radiant heat baking across the road at him, tightening his skin, making it feel shiny. His eyes were gushing water in protest. Another burning chunk of metal, this one better than 7 feet across at its widest and shaped like a diamond, fell out of the sky, landed in the ditch 20 feet to his left, and the dry leaves on top of the wet moss were instantly ablaze. Kafwam! Kafwam! If he stayed here, he would go up in a jigging, screaming blaze of spontaneous combustion. He scrambled to his feet and began to run along the shoulder of the highway in the direction of Gary, the breath getting hotter and hotter in his lungs. The air had begun to taste like heavy metal. Presently, he began to feel his hair to see if he had started burning. The sweet stench of gasoline filled the air, seeming to coat him. Hot wind rippled his clothes. He felt like something trying to escape from a microwave oven. The road doubled before his watering eyes, then trebled. There was another coughing roar as rising air pressure caused the Cheery Oil Company office building to implode. Scimitars of glass wickered through the air. Chunks of concrete and cinder block rained out of the sky and hailed on the road. A whizzing piece of steel about the size of a quarter and the thickness of a Mars bar sliced through Trashcan's shirt sleeve and made a thin scrape on his skin. A piece big enough to have turned his head to guava jelly struck in front of his feet and then bounded away, leaving a good-sized crater behind. Then he was beyond the fallout zone, still running, the blood beating in his head as if his very brain had been sprayed with number 2 heating oil and then set ablaze. Kahwam! That was another one of the tanks, and the air resistance in front of him seemed to disappear, and a large, warm hand pushed him firmly from behind, a hand that fitted every contour of his body from heels to head. It shoved him forward with his toes barely touching the road, and now his face bore the terrified, pan-sweating grin of someone who has been attached to the world's biggest kite in a high cap of wind, and let loose to fly, fly, baby, up into the sky until the wind goes somewhere else, leaving him to scream all the way down in a helpless power dive. From behind, a perfect fusillade of explosions, God's ammunition dump going up in the flames of righteousness, Satan storming heaven, his artillery captain a fiercely grinning fool with red flayed cheeks, Trash Can Man by name, never to be Donald Merwin Elbert again. Sights jittering by, cars wrecked off the road, Mr. Strang's blue mailbox with the flag up, a dead dog with its legs up, a power line down in a cornfield. The hand was not pushing him quite so hard now. Resistance had come back in front. Trash risked a glance back over his shoulder and saw that the knoll where the oil tanks had stood was a mass of fire. Everything was burning. The road itself seemed to be on fire back there, and he could see the summer trees going up like torches. He ran another quarter mile, then dropped into a puffing, blowing, shambling walk. A mile further on, he rested, looking back, smelling the glad smell of burning. With no fire trucks and firefighters to put it out, it would go whatever way the wind took it. It might burn for months. Powhatanville would go, and the fire line would march south, destroying houses, villages, farms, crops, meadows, forests. It might get as far south as Terre Haute, and it would burn that place he had been in. It might burn further. In fact, his eyes turned north again, toward Gary. He could see the town now, its great stacks standing quiet and blameless, like strokes of chalk on a light blue blackboard. Chicago beyond that. How many oil tanks? How many gas stations? How many trains standing silent on sidings full of LP gas and flammable fertilizer? How many slums as dry as kindling? How many cities beyond Gary and Chicago? There was a whole country ripe for burning under the summer sun. Grinning, Trash Can Man got to his feet and began to walk. His skin was already going lobster red. He didn't feel it, although that night it would keep him awake in a kind of exultation. There were bigger and better fires ahead. His eyes were soft and joyful and utterly crazy. They were the eyes of a man who has discovered the great axle of his destiny and has laid his hands upon it.